Let's open our Bibles to Revelation chapter 8 this morning. Diane and I stopped by the church here on Monday evening, and there was a vehicle driving circles in the parking lot. Round and round it went. And I recognized the vehicle, and I wondered just a little bit what was happening. And then the vehicle pulled up to where we were standing, and the passenger side window went down, and it was Pastor Rob in the passenger side. And he said hello. And then I realized that his son Caleb was the one who was driving. And then I realized what was happening, that this was some pre-driver's training that was taking place, which I think any parent who does this deserves a helmet and a plaque. It's a very wise thing to do some pre-driver's training, and it was going on. But it reminded me of a principle, and the principle is that people more often need to be reminded than they need to be instructed. And I say that specifically regarding driver's training, because I think all of you know that some lessons need to be shared more than once. You have probably, if you've been in this process with a teenager, you've had to remind them several times when to use the brake and when to not, and that sort of thing. We need reminders because it's important. And in our walk with God, we need reminders because our walk with God is important. It's critical. We need reminders. So I'm going to say some things today that I've said before, and I'm going to quote someone that I've quoted before because I think these things really matter. Eugene Peterson wrote this: the first century church that received this letter, the Revelation, had no weapons, no votes, little money, and no prestige. Why didn't they have mental breakdowns? Why didn't they cut and run? Why? Because they worshiped and they prayed. They worshiped and they prayed. This chapter that we're about to read this morning has some awful things to consider in it. But we would make a mistake if we jumped to those things and skipped over the practices and the theology behind those practices that kept the people of God from mental breakdowns and from cutting and from running. So let's take a look. Revelation chapter 8, just verses 1 through 5 to start. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about a half an hour. Then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Now, remember what we read about in the last chapter, chapter 7. It was much about worship. And, of course, if you don't know this yet, we're studying the book of Revelation as something that is yet to come. We're taking a futurist view of this book. We believe that what we're reading about here is what we can expect in days to come. And so there's this great worship scene in heaven around the throne. There's a multitude of people. There's angels, the elders, the four living creatures. And they combine together in offering up praise and thanksgiving and honor and glory and blessing to the Lamb and to the one who sits on the throne. This really epic scene of worship then is followed by, you notice what I read, silence. 30 minutes of silence. Now, I did entertain the idea for just a few moments about not saying anything for the first 5 minutes that I stood up here. But I changed my mind. I'm not going to do that because it's really awkward to be in a room full of people with total silence for 5 minutes. Let alone 30 minutes. But it is okay to be silent. I'm not saying that's the principal point of this verse. In fact, most scholars admit they do not know what is the point of this? I'm not saying that I know, except to say that by way of application, silence before God is a good idea. Shut off the noise. Now, we find this in other places in the scripture. For example, Job finally decided to quit talking at one point. Remember all the accusations that Job made to God and about God and his other friends made about him? And Job finally decided, after he'd been questioned by God for two chapters, I'm going to stop talking now. What he actually said was, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth." In other words, sometimes when you're before God, it's a good idea to shut up and be quiet. Habakkuk chapter 2, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. I know that parents do this. I've heard it here at church, and I've heard it yelled in vans. I've been in family gatherings where a parent has to say, "Quiet! Knock it off. Still." Zephaniah 1, verse 7. "Be silent before the sovereign Lord, for the day of the Lord is near." Zechariah chapter 2, verse 13. "Be still before the Lord, all mankind, because he has roused himself from his holy dwelling." I think maybe those verses were a forecast of this particular moment that we read about in Revelation. Some people hate silence so much they'll fill the air with any noise at all. They'll turn on the TV first thing in the morning and they'll just let anybody talk to them about anything. And they let it play all day long just so they can have the air filled with some noise. You know, I think sometimes we don't want to hear what we think we might hear in silence. And that's why we keep all the noise going all the time. We either keep talking ourselves or we keep the noise coming in some particular way. But I'll tell you this, there is a day coming, a day of great worship, followed by 30 minutes of silence to contemplate, to surrender, and to consider what God is doing. Verse 2 says, "Then I saw, after the worship and the silence, seven angels will be given seven trumpets." Now, we'll get to that, but the trumpets are not the central theme of the paragraph that we just read. The central theme of this first paragraph is prayer. And I think what you see here is a flow. If you back up from the text and get out of all the details for a minute, and you look at the flow of these two chapters, what you see is worship and silence and prayer. That wouldn't be a bad rhythm for life, would it? Worship, silence, prayer. Take a walk in the garden with the ladies. Worship, silence, prayer. Verse 3, we'll let the scholars debate which angel it is, and some of them think they know, and what altar means, and why the censer is golden, and all of that. Here's what we need to know. This incense, as the text says, is a symbol of the prayers of all the saints. Verse 4 says, "The prayers of the saints." The saints before the throne, the saints on the earth, the saints of all the ages, the saints of Calvary Baptist Church. What's important for us to know is this: prayers are heard because prayer matters. Prayer matters. It matters to God. Now, let's not complicate prayer. As one of my favorite authors has said, quote, "Prayer is conversation with God about matters of mutual concern." I love that definition. Prayer is conversation with God about matters of mutual concern. In other words, we're talking with him about what concerns us, and we're talking with him about what concerns him. And he's talking with us about what concerns him, and he's talking with him about what concerns us. There's this interchange, this dialogue, this relationship. A man who is mentoring me in my walk with God says it even more simply. He said, "Whenever we turn our attention to God, we're praying." Even if we're not saying anything. Whenever we simply turn our attention to God, we're praying. Now, it shouldn't be that hard to turn our attention to God. But you all know it is. So many times we're paying more attention to our own thoughts. We're paying more attention to our own looping narrative. We're paying more attention to our own stream of consciousness. I was talking to somebody this week that said, yes, I am guilty of lazy brain. Lazy brain. And what the person meant by that was that they know they have this looping narrative. They know they have the stream of consciousness, but it takes some extra effort to turn all that toward God and to invite him into it. To invite God into what we're thinking about, to invite God into what we're struggling with, to invite God into what we're mulling over. There's many different ways to pray, and I want to give you just a few examples this morning because prayer is in this text. It's not directly in this text and what I'm about to tell you, but this is by way of application. And this is not an exhaustive list, all right? Not an exhaustive list. But just for curiosity, this is not in my notes. I'm always dangerous when I leave my notes. But how many of you struggle with prayer? Okay. All right. Quite a few of you. So for those of you that don't, just check out for a minute. But for the rest of you, I want to give you just a few ideas that might be of some assistance to you. All right? First of all, breath prayer. Breath prayer doesn't take anything but breathing. And if you're not doing that, you have a bigger problem. All right? So breath prayer is just on the inhale, I invite you in. On the exhale, I'm letting this go. I invite you in, I'm letting this go. Whatever the situation is that you may be dealing with that's driving you absolutely crazy. Now, unless you're driving, you can also use your hands. Unless you have a self-driving car. But, you know, you can be going down the road and you should keep your hands on the wheel. But if you're not going down the road, I invite you in. I'm letting this go. Breath prayer. You may need to do that a number of times. It involves the body in this, you see. Not just the mind and the spirit. But deep, deep breaths may help you. You say, this sounds like yoga or something to me. Well, fine. If you're stretching, do that. I don't care. I'm just saying, you know, think about this. Use your body to engage in this. Another kind of prayer is centering prayer. When you read the word in the morning or you read a devotional guide, ask God for a word or a phrase that will center your thinking on him. And then find a means to remind you of that word or that phrase. I tie this thing on my wrist in the morning with my centering prayer. I ask God for something, and I ask him to help me understand it and then to keep it throughout the day. It's like my Pharisaical phylactery, you might say. And I had this phrase, and today my phrase is, I'm not alone, you are with me. Because I never want to stand in this pulpit alone. And I just need to be reminded that he's always with me. He never leaves me alone. And that's not the same thing every day. It's not even the same thing every Sunday. But all I'm saying is something that recenters us when our thoughts start to stray or intrusive thoughts begin to come. Recenter yourself. That is a purpose of prayer. It's not the only purpose of prayer. But it is a part of why we have this privilege of prayer. Prayer realigns us with reality. Centers us. Journaling prayer is another way to pray. And that simply is what it says. Just write your prayers. Instead of starting Dear Diary, you know, write Dear God. And write your prayers to him. Address him personally. Write them out. And I'll tell you in a minute how some ways to help that. But let's say you're really going through a very difficult time. Just pour it out. Write it down. Get it on paper. It's amazing how that can be helpful to you. You say, well, what if somebody reads it? Well, then smack them. with the journal, you know. No, that's for you. That's for you and God. And get it down. I can find this to be so cleansing sometimes. And then there's guided prayer. And you can combine this with your journal. But what I mean by this is use the scripture to guide your praying. The Lord's Prayer, for example, was given by Jesus as an outline to pray. Not just to rattle it off 10 times or whatever, but to actually use it as an outline for prayer. New Testament places like Ephesians chapter 1 and Ephesians chapter 3 and Philippians chapter 1. Go to those chapters, read those prayers, and then pray those prayers. Personalize them. The Psalms, they were given not only as the songbook of Israel, but as the prayer book of the church. And one of the things that I love to do is I have this thing called a Psalter. And on the one side, on the left-hand side, is the psalm and the text of the psalm. And on the right-hand side is a blank page. And I like to rewrite the psalm. It's not an inspiration thing. But I'm just rewriting the psalm to personalize it into my own situation and into my own context. And you say, well, man, that must take some time. Yeah, that's the point. Take some time to do this. Be silent before the Lord. Jot down some of these things. Welcoming prayer is another form of prayer. Welcoming prayer means you welcome whatever you are currently feeling as an invitation to meeting with God. Now, if you're sad, you say, Lord, I welcome this sadness. Some of you are saying, no, I'm trying to get rid of it. But maybe the sadness is exactly the kind of thing that God is trying to use to heal something. Maybe it's something he wants to speak to you about. So welcome it. Try it. Just try welcoming. Welcoming whatever you're feeling. Welcome the sadness. Welcome the frustration. I often have to welcome anger. I'm sorry, but that is my default emotion. I wish it wasn't. I wish I had something else. But sometimes I'm just like, woo! And I've learned to just now say, Lord, I welcome this anger. Who shall I punch now? No, not really. That is not what I say. But I say, Lord, I welcome this anger. Now, why is it here? Why am I angry? What's going on with this? And then I ask the Lord, do I have a right to be angry? And 99 times out of 100, he says, right? He said, no, you're being a twit. Now, he doesn't really speak like that to me, but, you know, I speak like that to me. But if I am angry and I have a right to be angry, then and the third question is, then what do I do with this now? Where do you want to meet me in this? What am I supposed to do with this? And what are you trying to heal something in my own heart? Are you trying to speak to a place in my heart that really needs to be dealt with? I welcome this right now, Father. Help me. Meet me in this. I think so often when we're experiencing adverse emotions, we just say, God, get me out of this mode. Instead of welcoming him into it and welcoming what he's trying to do. Then there's meditative prayer. If you could take an hour or a half a day or even a whole day, that would freak some of you right out, wouldn't it? What if you just spent the whole day reading the Word and then interacting with the Word, and then reading the Word and interacting with the Word? I tell you, it would change your view about a lot of things. Prayer is a privilege. You don't need an appointment. Prayer is given assistance. God gives us divine assistance according to Romans chapter 8. God answers prayer. Prayer becomes a means of our participation with God's actions. You know, you might have some of those things where you say, I can't do anything about this. What am I supposed to do? And then the pastor says, pray. And you're like, yeah, and what else? See, that implies that we don't think God's actually engaging us in the process of helping him and working with him and being helped by him. Prayer engages us in God's actions. We become participants in God's actions. Now go back to the text again and look at verse 5. It says, then the angel took the censer, that's all those prayers, and he filled it with fire from the altar, and he threw it on the earth. Do you have that picture in your mind? Here's the prayers of all the saints. And then he takes coals, dumps it in on top of it, and chucks it to the earth. Woo! What power are we dealing with here? One commentator said it this way. quote, prayer never reaches God in the clumsy, inept, feeble way that it leaves our lips. The Holy Spirit's energizing and the risen Lord's endorsement make them a force to be reckoned with in the universe. Wow. It's kind of like when you pray, it's like when you teach a kid to use a gun, and I'm in, you know, Greenville, so I can talk about that kind of thing, but maybe I can't. But when you teach a kid to use a gun, you always tell them, now make sure you know where that thing is pointed. And that reminder has to be given again and again and again. And because there's power here. And we when we pray, there's power. You say, well, I never prayed for my prayers to get mixed with fire and thrown on the earth. I mean, I never prayed for that one time. Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever prayed that God's name would be hallowed? You ever prayed for the glory of God? Have you ever prayed that God's kingdom would come? Have you ever prayed that his will would be done? Oh, then you prayed for this. You prayed for this. You definitely prayed for this. All those prayers for hallowing God's name, all those prayers for his kingdom to come, all those prayers for his will to be done, they result in peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Again, second of four times that this happens. Friends, I just want to say to you this morning, pray without ceasing and never underestimate the God who hears and answers prayer. Again, I'm not suggesting it's the primary interpretation here, but I do think it's a helpful application for our own well-being to establish a rhythm, a personal rhythm of worship and silence and prayer. Now, the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, and these were thrown upon the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. The second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many people died from the water because it had been made bitter. The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth," or literally to earth dwellers, "at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow." When the seventh seal is opened, chapter 8, verse 1, seven angels are given seven trumpets. So you might say that the seventh seal is the seven trumpets, or at least another level of intensity of the seals described differently. We'll see how these seals, trumpets, and bowls all kind of overlap one another as we go through them. But in verse 7, you have this first trumpet. Hail, fire, mixed with blood. Now, I don't know if John meant blood, or some people think he meant lava, like red stuff falling out of the sky. Whatever it is, it's nasty. And you'll notice what happens. The effect of it is that a third of the earth will be burned up. Now, it's hard to imagine great burning fires. Whole regions up in smoke. The smoke of which flows to other places. Actually, it's not. We've just been through this. A third of the trees, almost all the vegetation, I say almost all because chapter 9, verse 4, there appears to be something green still left, if this is in any kind of order. As I have mentioned, it's not really hard to imagine something like this. It's almost like God is giving us some glimpses of these kinds of events beforehand. Fires, earthquakes, storms. We can see this happening. And of course, we're blaming it all now on climate change. I realize that. And I'm not saying there is no climate change. I'm just saying that's what we blame it all on now. In those days to come, nobody's going to blame it on climate change. It's going to be clear where it's coming from. If creation as it is daily doesn't cause us to be in awe of God's power, wait until he starts using it in other ways. Like when you step outside at night and you look up into the sky and you see all those beautiful stars up there, if that doesn't cause a person to be impressed with some sort of designer and some kind of glory, wait till those babies start dropping. That'll change your mind. It should change our mind. Whether it does or not, of course, that's up to our own heart. Trumpet 2 in verse 8, something like a mountain on fire, is thrown into the sea or into the ocean. It must be like a giant asteroid of some sort. And note the effect of it. One third of the sea will become like blood, like Egypt. And one third of the living creatures in the sea will die. And one third of the ships will be destroyed. Now you can imagine an object of that size hitting the ocean. There will be tsunamis, massive disruption on the sea and in ports all around the world. It says one third of the ships will be destroyed. There are currently 116,000 registered ocean-going merchant ships. So if my math is right, that means over 38,000 ships will be destroyed. One thing this says to me is that people will still be trying to do business in the middle of all this. Still trying to make money. Still trying to double-click their Amazon order from China. Still trying to make money despite the things that are happening in the world. Some of you may have seen a movie from the late 90s titled Armageddon. The premise in the story is that there's this giant asteroid the size of Texas, and it's flying toward the Earth. And so NASA comes up with this idea that to find these deep Earth driller guys, Bruce Willis and a couple other guys, and they fly them out to the asteroid. And they bore a hole in the middle of the asteroid, and they put a nuclear bomb in it. And in all their wisdom, the idea is that they will split the asteroid in two so that it gets closer to the Earth. It'll fly around on either side of this. Some of you are going to probably watch this movie tonight just to see what happens. But I'm going to give you a spoiler, okay? Sorry. That movie came out in the 90s. If you haven't seen it by now, it's not my fault, all right? So I'm just gonna say, you should imagine what actually happens in the movie. Of course they are successful. It's Hollywood. And mankind can do anything we aspire to do, including stopping a Texas-sized asteroid from destroying the Earth. We're that good. We are that good. Yep. I think we need 30 minutes of silence. Obviously, there's a day coming when a gimmick like that will not work. And the asteroid will hit. And it will be messy. Verse 10, trumpet number 3, another object from space, a great star of some sort, heads toward the earth, and instead of landing in one piece like trumpet number two, it seems that this one breaks apart at the atmosphere, and it strikes springs and rivers, and it affects fresh water. Fresh water will be polluted. People will die from drinking the water that's impacted by these particles. The star will be called wormwood because of the bitterness that it will produce. Wormwood is bitter. In other words, the effect will be as bitter as wormwood. Trumpet number 4, verse 12, says the sun, moon, and stars are struck, which probably means there'll be one-third less light. In other words, a day will be one-third light and one-third night and one-third total darkness. Talk about climate change. Temperatures will fluctuate wildly. Tidal movements in the ocean will likely change. Schedules as people have known them and charted them for many years will all be altered. No doubt people will try to explain this all away. I think the USA will blame China or Russia, and China and Russia will blame the USA. And here in the USA, the Democrats will blame the Republicans, and the Republicans will blame the Democrats and say, if you'd have voted for me, you know, this never would have happened. And everybody will probably blame the believers, wherever they are, kill them for the good of the nation. People will do all they can to avoid the obvious. God is often speaking. You know, God is often speaking. There are present warnings, I think, about our vulnerability as human beings. There's earthquakes, there's fires, there's lettuce with parasites. It's not funny if it's happened to you, but I mean, really, you know, candy doesn't have parasites. I'm just saying. The candy won't get you. The lettuce might take you out. Someone has put it this way, quote, God will not let us off. He will not indulge our inattention. He will be taken seriously. However practiced we become at tuning out sounds that we do not want to hear, including God's displeasure at sin, God finds new ways to penetrate our defensive deafness. Unquote. Now look at verse 13 again. Then I looked and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow. An eagle, maybe one of the four living creatures that says it looks like an eagle, chapter 4, verse 7, will fly directly overhead announcing three woes to the earth dwellers. The earth dwellers are not just those who live on the earth, but it refers to a particular kind of people who live for the earth, who live for the things of the earth, who are worldly, you might say. Chapter 13, verse 8 uses the exact same word for those who worship the beast. I suppose some people are going to just say, well, that's not a real eagle, that's just a drone. I'm sure the government is flying a drone, try to scare us. If any of you have been thinking about how similar these trumpets and their effect are to the plagues of Egypt when God's people were liberated, good job. If you haven't thought about it, go back and look at it again. There are some parallels here between the plagues in Egypt and what's happening here. God's people were praying. God sent plagues to get Pharaoh to repent. The earth, the water, the heavens were all affected. But instead of repenting, as we know in Egypt, the hearts of people just got harder. And the account of what happened in Egypt, I think, is a micro of what will happen to the earth in macro. In other words, God has done these kinds of things. He is doing and allowing similar things to happen today so that we cannot say, oh, that sort of thing would never happen. Clearly, it will. It does. Now, I started out this morning mentioning the principle that people need to be reminded more often than they need to be instructed. Reminded not only of what God can and will do, but reminded of some practices that I think might help us mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. As I said, it's not the primary interpretation here, but there is a rhythm that I think would be helpful for us today, a rhythm of worship and prayer and silence. A conversation with God about matters of mutual concern. I suggested some various prayer practices that you could give a try this week as you attempt to navigate the swamp of life. Finally, remember the point of all this is not that God will finally prove that he is mighty. You know, God is proving that he is mighty every single day. Every single day, the earth continues its rotation and it stays on its path and the universe does what it does. And all of that, that's all evidence of God's mighty hand. He's displaying his eternal Godhead through the things that we can see. So he doesn't have to prove that he is mighty, but he will do all these things one day to provide another opportunity for people to be saved. That's the point of this. Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And if you haven't received his salvation, then I hope you will. I pray you will say yes to his gracious offer today.